Well, he says Esau.com. If you send mail to phil.becker@esau.com, I want that to end up on my machine at home in my den where I read mail. Why? Because mail is different. Why is it different? Because I'm a human being and I think it's different. And most of my life's explaining the difference to the machine, which is far more logical and rigorous and doesn't like those kind of vaguenesses. But the difference between email connections and a direct connection is very important in the domain name system, and we'll get into that. There's whole structures in there where you can say, if this name is being looked up to send email, here's where it's supposed to go. If this name's being looked up to connect to with web or FTP or whatever, then here's where it's supposed to go. So the phone book has got a little bit more information around a name, I guess is the way to put it, hook with it, than just a single phone number. But the operation is absolutely identical. However, this phone book is huge. How big is it? Well, you know that domain names are being added at 1,000 a day. There's millions of them. There's bunches of names for the same computer. There's a lot of names for people that don't even have computers. They have an email account on some server somewhere, but they don't want to use that server's name. I don't want it to be phil@netcom.com. I want it to be phil@plb.com. It's my initials. I want it to be where people send me mail. So I get a name. And so the name, man, the phone book may have 1,000 names that all end up sending it to this one computer that holds mail for all these people at Netcom, let's say, or CompuServe or someplace. Administration issues, and we'll go through those. Managing the distributed phone book is what DNS is mostly all about, and handling the technical differences between email and direct computer connections. How can you have control over your name, put in your own numbers, change your own addresses, and have that happen throughout the world immediately when you make the edits and the changes is what DNS is all about. And then there's an administrative structure that says, how do you get that control in the first place over a name, or how do you give it back? So that's really the summary here of what this class is going to be about at the big level. And when you leave tomorrow evening, you're going to know all these things. And you're going to know them in a lot more detail than you think possible right now. If I'm successful, you'll know them better than most people know them anywhere. If I'm marginally successful, you'll still stand out dramatically over most people who try to deal with this stuff. My goal here in this section is to get you oriented, to get you to understand that this is what it's about. It's a big LAN. Its purpose is to hook software on one computer to software on another computer. Because it's going over such a huge area, the entire globe, there isn't a single wire between these two computers. So there has to be a whole structure of pieces of wires hooked together, owned by different people. One person put this wire in, a different person put this wire in, another person put this wire in, whereby all this can be coordinated, managed, and made to work so that when you want to go somewhere from your computer, it just happens. Routers are the connections that make that happen. They hook the different segments of addresses together. And routing is what creates that wire. IP addresses are what name electrically the machines. Those are those numbers. That's the level at which the electronics work. This is the level at which people work, domain name systems. The mapping of domain names back to what the hardware needs to see is the administration of the domain name system. You have to learn how to do that so that you can make up a name, and when somebody tries to use that name in the internet, it does what you want it to do. Translates properly to the right IP addresses or sends email to the right machines. Leased line technologies and issues come up when you start to make this connection. You had this LAN, it wasn't hooked up. You wanted it to be hooked up. You had to add a router, you had to add a leased line to somewhere. On the other end, although you will never see it, is just another wire and another router that starts hooking you into a group of these things that gets you step by step to the other machine. And ultimately, the whole point of all of this technology is to let you do this. Client-server computing. Have a client program on this computer, connect through a wire to a server program on this computer, and together accomplish the shared task that has part of its mission in one machine and part of its mission on the other, and create a unified whole. That's what the internet's about. That's how it works. That's all there is. There is no more. Everything about it is a detail in this picture as you start to get down to the bottom to make all the pieces work. Your details are going to be clustered out in this part because you're probably more out here than in here. And it's a good thing because these routers are really expensive. This router might cost you a couple $1,000s. This will cost you a couple $100,000. And just because it's bigger. But you know what it does? Exactly the same thing, just more of it and faster. There is no other difference. Except you write a bigger check and you get something that goes faster and does more. What I want to do in this class is get you to see that this is something you can understand. It is within your grasp to figure out how the entire internet works. It's not a mystery that you cannot get your arms around. And if you get your arms around it, you get control over it. Because if you understand it, then you're not at its mercy. It becomes your tool. That's the point. That's what this class is all about. That's what the product, the iPad, is all about, to take a lot of the complication out of it, to make it easier, to make you able to use it rather than worry about it, to be able to have an idea of what you want to hook up and have it hooked up and working as quickly as possible. And with the least amount of time spent in fretting over all this detail. Because when something gets this big, it can get so much detail that you spend all your time in the details and you can't get past them. There's just so many of them. And that's why I wanted this introduction to lay out for you that this is it. You now know everything there is in the internet. There is no more. You don't know it very well yet. You know it, just kind of see the surface of it. And the rest of this class is going to be take you from that surface down. So that you can see how the pieces work. Is it break time at 10 or 10:30? Okay, so we've got a half an hour. What I'd like to do is stop right here and take any questions anybody's got. Are there anything that you think's part of the internet that you don't think's in this picture? I'm claiming I've told you about the entire internet, everything about it. The old Johnny Carson, everything you ever, all of that. I want to know if you think there's something about the internet, there's a piece of the internet that you know about, you're wondering about, and that you don't know where it is in this drawing. They're out here. They're, I draw a little chair here, and I'll put them in front of a little stick man sitting right there. There they are in front of their computers. The other piece that you should be able to understand right now, what I was waiting for somebody to say, is what about a dial-up customer? Because I don't have any dial-up customers on here. Dial-up customer, basically, is you put a terminal server on this LAN, you hook them to modems, and they hook on a modem, and their computer's down here. The point being, when they dialed in, they're part of the picture now. They're just plugged into the network. That is no different than me bringing up a fourth computer over here and plugging it into the Ethernet. Except that it's slower.
I have a question. question.
Yeah.
Could you demystify multiplexed packet switches? I know they're complex terms for something.
Yeah, I've got a little time here. This might be as good a shot. I normally will do that when we get into that part of it. But multiplexed just means, I'm going to erase this diagram. Is that okay? Everybody? All right. I didn't want to erase it if anybody still wanted a piece of it. So I'm going to use some Windex during the break. While I was drying them out, I'm making them more permanent than they ought to be. The concept of multiplexing is you have a whole lot of wires out here that you logically want to think of as a wire from here to here. But you don't want to spend all the money to run that many wires. So you feed all these wires into one wire, and then you fan them all back out on this end. Now, how you multiplex, there's a lot of different technologies. There's time division multiplexing. There's frequency division multiplexing. There's statistical multiplexing. Time division multiplexing says that if these are four wires of this size, this has to be a wire four times as big. And when you time division multiplex, 1/4 of this wire can handle each one of these. And literally, this behaves as though it's a point-to-point wire of the full size. You haven't lost a thing. Gosh, he figured it out. Statistical multiplexing says this wire might be, let's say twice as big as one of those wires. Because I know you want a wire from here to here, but you're only using it half the time, on average. So if I put four people using their wires half the time into a wire twice the size of one of those single wires, obviously I saved money because I had to have half the wire here. It's cheaper. But what happens if everybody wants to all use their full wire at the same time? They go half speed. But on average, they don't do that. And so on average, it works the way you would expect it to. That's statistically multiplexed. Average is a statistical measure. Statistical multiplex means we just guarantee things on averages. Or mean deviations, or three sigma, some statistical measure. This all sounds really complicated to try to snow you so you don't look under the surface and realize what I sold you was half the wire. Probably at a little bit more than half the price. Yeah? Mm-hmm. You're absolutely correct, and that's why I don't mean to denigrate these services. I simply mean for you to understand them so you can make an intelligent buying decision. There are absolutely cases where this is the smart buy, because it may cost you 40% less for what in general is very close to the same service, except for those bursty periods once in a while when it kind of gets choppy and falls apart, and then it comes right back. And that happened to be when these three guys who were sharing it with you suddenly got busy. Then when they quit being busy, it went back to being good again. And it could be that in your case, or in many cases, that having that burst speed, that average speed of a lot faster than that same money would buy with a guarantee most of the time, is a very good thing to do, because you got a lot more for your money. But once in a while, you'll get a little less for your money. That's the average thing. Yes?
One part I don't understand. You always have a point-to-point connection from, let's say, your office to the first point.
Correct.
But after that point, there might be a frame relay connection.
Well, and it's not, it's a question of what you buy. You'll get what you buy. None of that's a mystery, okay? And I'm not sure if that's the way you're asking the question, is how would I know what's there?
Well, my question is, if I buy a router that is point-to-point, it doesn't support frame relay.
Correct.
And then if someone upstream from me changes this router or changes this connection so that it keeps frame relay,
won't affect you, because when you buy the service, you buy a certain kind of service. That's what I said. They won't just change it on you. That's not what happens.
So even if it's three hops away from you?
If it's three hops away from you, the router converts the protocols.
Okay, so.
A router, remember how, and we'll get into a little more of this when we get to routers, which we'll get to toward the end of today, is you might have a frame relay line come in that interface. It might come out here in Ethernet for local, and it might come out here a T1 to go somewhere else. But part of the router's job is to handle those protocols on each port, strip the IP packet out of this protocol, repackage it into this protocol to send it on its way. So nothing that happens past the next router on the other end of the wire will affect you as far as protocols are concerned. It can affect you as far as speed if they slow it down or speed it up, but what technology they use on the next wire won't affect your wire because the router in between makes that conversion. Yes?
You're only guaranteed speed.
Absolutely.
I mean,
when you buy a wire, you can only guarantee what that wire does. And it does it from where you are to where it goes. And what happens next is another wire someone else bought.
Is there any standard that the main router that comes with traffic?
Yeah, it's a standard thing that you ought to check it out. No, the answer is no.
Is there an average?
No, the answer is no. Pretty much the T1 to E1 type speeds, if you're going into anything that's is a real provider connection to the internet, the rest of it behind that will be faster than that. But even that's not always a lock. Depends on some of the networks. We're going to get into things like NAPs and network access points, and a lot of times the wire can be fast enough, but the router it hooks into isn't up to the job, and it slows down. So there's a lot of things in this loop to slow down.
Are these speeds actually, as time goes on, getting faster than what the equipment is worth?
Generally speaking, the farther you get into the middle, the faster it's getting. The closer you are to the edge, the more people are trying to cut it and sell it cheap, and the slower it's getting. And so we'll go through some of that. Huh?
Kind of wipes each other out.
Well, not really. It gives you some options. If you, for instance, want to hook to the internet with a T1 line, let's say, for the sake of this discussion, what you'll do is shop providers. And you'll discover that the T1 line, the wire, is totally a function, it's a fixed price, totally a function of how far away the building that provider has is from you. So you have a little bit of variation there, because one of them might say that you can run it 2 miles and reach me, another one you might have to run it 30 miles to reach. That can make quite a difference. But in general, most of them will be within a range of not that much of a price for the actual wire. Now you're going to talk port charges. And that's based on how much he's got coming in his back end, how much equipment he's got in the room. Did he buy expensive equipment, cheap equipment? And you'll find one guy will say, I'll hook up a T1 port charge for $500. Another guy will say, it's $3,000. And you'll find every price in between. And if he's priced it based on reality, the guy who's selling it to you cheaper has brought less in or cut it up more than the guy who's not.
If you're running a slow line from you to your provider, then you probably don't need...
You don't care. So you can go to a guy who's got doesn't have to have that much coming into him to handle a 56K line, do you say? Exactly.
You know, you don't need it high back end.
That's correct. And so, and we'll show you in the routing class how to use traceroute and some facilities and stuff to find how relative speeds of things and how to see what the links look like.
I would assume also if you're bypassing providers, like you may go to a provider who's also going to someone else. You may
find that you go straight to that company. Yes, that's also correct. In general, as you hop it up the line, it's going to cost you more, but you're going to get a better, less filtered connection. And then ultimately, there's maybe in the United States a half a dozen to 10 companies that have pretty significant backbones of their own or have built backbones with people like Metropolitan Fiber or some of those that have real substantial fiber optics backbones, like Sprint, MCI, ANS, UUNet.
Are
those kind of people. And if you go straight to them, then you're straight on their backbone of whatever size they've got. Now, there's quite a bit of variance even between those. Sprint's backbone is the fastest backbone, but their routers are the oldest and most clogged. So they have, on one hand, the best service out there. On the other, they're suffering for the last few months because it's overloaded, especially at the Washington, D.C. routers and a couple of others, where the routers are just clogging up, and they're having to upgrade routers. It's going to cost them several million dollars to put the next size router in, and they're doing it one at a time when they have to. MCI, on the other hand, has great routers, but the wires between them are not so good. UUNet, ANS all have whatever Metropolitan Fiber does, because they're all renting Metropolitan Fiber space as their backbone. Fascinating thing, Jack Rickard of Boardwatch Magazine publishes the Internet Directory. The latest issue that's just out, he has published a map, the most complete map ever done, of where the real wires are in the Internet in the United States. Who does what with who? And it's fascinating reading.
What book is this?
It's the Internet Service Providers Directory, ISP Directory. And it's out. The latest issue, I think, just came out. It's a quarterly publication. It's basically a list of ISPs sorted by phone number and directory. And you can look up your state, your area, and it's published for people to be able to locate where they can go buy it. But he always does a whole set of Internet stuff in the front of it. This time he mapped out. The first issue had an actual map of all the ISPs in the book, which was like 1,500. Now he's up to about 2,800, I think, on his list and growing of where they were. Now he's mapped the whole backbones of all the ANS and MCI and AT&T and Sprint and where the NAPs are and who's got wires where.
I thought AT&T was putting this all out of business.
It's a fascinating story that if somebody's got another question, I'll defer this story till later because we're really here for other things. But
quick one on a T1 span. Where we're located at, the phone company can't give us VHCS, so they hooked us up with AMI.
That's correct.
Okay, they told us there wasn't going to be that much of a loss.
It's not that much. And, you know, if they can't do it, they can't do it. We'll get into exactly what that means and exactly how much loss there is on that in the leased line segment of the class. We'll go over BHZS, ESF, AMI, D4, all that stuff. You'll be acronymed well and truly. And not only that, in theory, you'll have some concept what they all mean. But yeah, basically, the AMI D4 is probably what they're giving you with older equipment. And AMI D4 in general will lose. Instead of 1.544 megabits, you'll get about
1.3.
Now you won't see it. You basically won't see it.
You're talking about the fiber links, like between Denver and Houston, your example earlier. Most of those are running at 2.4 gigabits.
That's correct. Yeah, they used to all be running OC3, which is 155 meg, but they've all been upping them to 2-point-something gigs here recently. And the problem, of course, is a lot of them now have 2.4 gig fibers with routers that can't go much more about 200 megabits. So they got to replace the routers all with the more expensive routers that can do the gigabit routing. Yeah, they're available without question, but they aren't purchased and installed in most places. And they're very expensive, and so they do them slowly. But yeah, and the whole thing is going up. But bandwidth on the backbone is not really an issue in the Internet. It just isn't. Yeah.
When we tell that into the self-port and it's choppy,
yes.
And you get ahead of it, are we passing through a spring relay thing that's not working?
No, or you might be. I don't know what your circuit looks like from where you are to it. It's possible, but most likely what you're just seeing is loading of some piece of the Internet, probably a router somewhere. Because in Telnet, especially to something like this board, it's done full duplex. Every character has to make the trip there and back before you see it. And that's pretty brutal in a packet switching network. And if the network's not really working, really super up to snuff, you'll see those delays, which have nothing. That's the difference between a delay and a speed. It might go there really fast, but just pause for a minute on the way before it comes back. And so there's latency delays where something sits for a moment before it takes the next step. And that's how things slow down generally in routers and stuff. It's something like telnetting to a full duplex bulletin board where you're getting echoes when you type will show you the internet performance breakdown faster than anything else you'll ever do. Because every time you hit a key, you're totally humanly in tune with how long it took that character to go all the way to the other end and come back. And that's what causes that choppiness. Because a lot of times what will happen is they'll get grouped up and you'll see like a burst of three or four happen. Because the first two or three delayed enough that they caught up with the other and got put into a packet altogether to come back. Yes?
Latency
is based on the load, and statistical multiplexed wires have a lot of latency. The frame relay circuit will have a lot of latency. May go fast, but have a lot of latency. An ISDN circuit will have a lot of latency. A 28.8 dial-up will have a lot of latency. For example, a 128K ISDN circuit is twice as fast as a 56K DS0 circuit, but it has 30 milliseconds of latency, whereas the 56K circuit has 8 milliseconds of latency. The best analogy, if any of you have been involved in bulletin boards long enough to remember back when they had the asymmetric modems like the HSTs, the high-speed modems, that was an example of speed versus latency. Those modems had very high latency turning the ends around, but they also had high speed. So if you sat on a 9600 baud connection and typed, it was really choppy, whereas if you were on a lot choppier than a 1200 baud full duplex connection would type very smoothly, whereas a 9600 baud of these asymmetrical would type very choppy. It's the same story. It's clearly going faster, but there's more latency. Yes?
And ISDN, one cause of latency?
The fact that ISDN is a statistically multiplexed circuitry. It is packet-switched networking. ISDN is frame relay at its heart. Uses the same protocols. It's better provisioned. They make sure that the backbones are fat enough that they don't have a lot of statistical delay because it's a voice service, so they don't have as much compression in the statistical algorithms. But it is, in fact, frame relay protocol, if you get the protocol specs, talks about ISDN because it's ISDN and frame relay have a few bits separated in the frames, and otherwise they're the same protocol. And because of that, it's got a lot of latency. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about May East and May West and the Little Garden and all of these magic places?
I would prefer to delay doing that. Don't let me forget it when we get into routing and how the backbones go. Generally, a quick, short answer is, remember I told you there is no backbone. There's, like Sprint has their wires, and MCI has their wires, and other people have their wires. NAPs, network access points they're called, of which May East and May West are the most infamous, are where all those come together and touch. So in essence, they're routers that route between the backbones. So if you are on a Sprint line and you connect to a computer that's on an MCI line, you're going to have to go to a network access point that connects the two backbones somewhere to get across from one of those backbones to the other. And those are the NAPs. And May East and May West are, in the United States, the most infamous because they're the most overloaded and the most responsible for wondrous effects in the internet. There's Chicago NAP, which you don't hear much about because it runs real well. And there's Fort Worth NAP. I think there's about six NAPs in the United States that hook different backbones together. May East and May West, however, are San Francisco and Washington, D.C. I guess it's Washington, D.C. is May East and San Francisco is May West. And they just happen to take the brunt of it. And it's pretty simple why. If you look at the map of usage of internet in the United States, 30% of it's in California. About 25% of it is in the Boston-Washington corridor. And those two NAPs get the brunt of that. Half the whole internet traffic is going to end up going through one of them if it jumps to another backbone. There are always plans to add more naps. That gets into the politics of the internet, which have been, some of you may have been in the internet long enough to remember the great kicks problems of some time back when they're going to charge you $10,000 to plug in. There's a very real underlying issue there called settlements. Okay, I build a backbone. I put $5 billion into laying fiber optics, and I've hooked up a whole bunch of clients. I'm Sprint, let's say. Okay, and now I'm MCI. I put out my billions, and I built my backbone, and I've got all my clients that I've signed up. Now, when Sprint hooks to me, their clients get the benefit of talking to all my clients. What's that worth? How much should they pay to be able to hook to me? They all want to, right? And Sprint's saying, now, wait a minute, all your clients want to hook to us. How much is that going to cost? Well, if they're roughly equal sized, it's pretty clear that it's about a trade. But a lot of these guys are nowhere near the same size. You hook up an ANS to a Sprint, and the balance is ANS is bringing a lot fewer customers than Sprint to the table. So shouldn't ANS be paying some settlement for packets that flow across the NAP to Sprint? Because their value of hooking to ANS went way up because you can talk to the people on Sprint. It's a very real economic issue. And what Kix did originally was to create a no settlements agreement. They got everybody to sign that everybody would call it a draw and go through the NAPs. Then they decided that they would charge anyone to hook to the NAPs a uniform free. We'll take, okay, it's still a draw, it's just a $10,000 a head draw now.
Who pays for the NAPs?
That's the issue. Who pays for the NAPs? Somebody has to.
Yeah.
And the answer is there's a charge to hook to the NAPs, and it's not a small one, because not many people hook up. Maybe, what, a dozen people are carrying this charge. Each backbone company has to pay to hook to the NAPs. The answer is it's a dynamic structure, politically evolving, changing, and the source of a significant amount of economic pressure in the internet. What Kix did, first of all, was make the issue go away. You subscribe to Kix, it costs you so much a year to subscribe, and Kix will pay for the NAPs. And your subscription fees basically pay for the NAPs. And then we'll just get all this political about who's bigger than who and who should be paying who. We'll just get it off the table. And they did that successfully, and then they darn near wrecked the whole thing with the $10,000 a head, because they tried to make every wire that hooked to the internet pay the NAP fee. And of course, it broke down. And now it's in a state of wild and woolly, and it could go any way, any day. And right now there are existing agreements where certain backbone providers are paying certain fees for the NAPs, and they're being run by consortiums, multiple consortiums, no one consortium is running them. So if one consortium decides to stick them up, two of the NAPs will go down and the other four will take the traffic. And the idea is to do that, but it's a very wild and woolly thing, and it's a very real issue, and it's one you don't think about a lot because it's happening way up here where you don't see it a lot. But that's an issue. I don't think any trouble's going to come out of it, but some rate changes up or down and some things like that, because obviously if Sprint's paying $15 million a year to run the NAP, it's going to come down to their customers in a rate. They're not going to pay for it. Their customers are going to pay for it ultimately, yeah.
Is the NAP similar to what we call in the Voice World Gateway Agreement?
Yes. Yeah. It's for the purposes of this discussion, they're the same. I mean, the differences are all in the small details, but the conceptually, it's the same exact sort of an arrangement. And as you know, there's access fees and all of that, and it's a hotly contested who's supposed to pay who what. Now, in the case of voice telephone, the FCC dictates it. One of the things about the internet right now is there's been no governmental mandates whatsoever in the United States. It's totally been arrived at by free market forces. And that's always a possibility that the FCC will decide, if it gets out of control at this point, I'm sure they would step in and Congress would pass some legislation and say, FCC, go mandate this and fix it. And if they fixed it, they'd probably fix it with a model very much like the voice telephone model, which would be incredibly expensive at an internet level. Incredibly expensive. So we all want to hope that that doesn't happen. Because that would cause internet rates to go up 5 to 10x over what they are today, on the spot. Just because people couldn't get along.
Are there any NAPs outside the U.S.?
Yes, there are NAPs all over the world. And it's the same concept. Anywhere, in fact, to some degree, and again, conceptually, that's the picture I'm trying to draw. A NAP is nothing but a router. The whole thing that makes it a NAP is it's a big router that hooks big pieces of the internet together. And when it breaks, because it hooks a whole lot of stuff together, yeah, a whole lot of stuff breaks all in one move. That's correct.
Let me be a NAP in, let's say, the UK that handles all the phone companies.
Yeah, and I don't know where they all are outside the United States, but there are a lot of them, and my guess is it's the same thing here. The internet there, in Europe, it's a lot more government regulated, so a lot more structured and laid out, I suspect. But in a lot of places, you know, it could be Fred builds three cities worth of internet, and Joe builds three other cities worth of internet, and Fred and Joe get together and put a router between them, and that's an app. Now, they both, Fred and Joe, need to hook to something that'll get them back to the United States and to Europe, so they hook to Randy's service that's over here that has a wire to the U.S., and he plugs in, and an app sort of grows there.
Yeah.
And that's how a lot of it's come about.
Well, a lot of the NAPs are under the control, or controlled by foreign governments or agencies in foreign governments.
Yeah, I guess in any point of the internet, if you use the words controlled by, I'm going to probably start to say you're probably really making more of it than is true, because there's almost none of it that's controlled by anybody. And in the United States is probably the most open about it. China is the most closed, and everybody else is somewhere in between. Most governments in Europe especially are pretty highly regulated. They are very afraid of letting go of regulatory control. The United States is basically, there is none. There's literally none. There was a little bit. Court yesterday threw it out. There's now once again none. Don't worry about it. It'll be back. But it's going to march towards more and more in the United States. It's inevitable. It can't stay uncontrolled and become an economic center of the country. It just, there's too many forces of the universe that will keep that from staying that way.
I want to see them find somebody $25,000 for showing dirty pictures from Sweden.
Well, it'll happen. If you want to see it, you'll see it.
Well,
I remember a few years ago, everybody was saying the same words in the bulletin board community, and there's some people spending the next 30 years of their life in jail along with the fine.
Well, I want to know how,
because they didn't think it would happen.
I want to know how they're going to do it to somebody who's in a foreign country.
Well, they won't. They'll do it to the wrong person there, just like they did it to the wrong people in the bulletin board structure. When a government is faced with regulating something they have to regulate, they regulate it where they can, which may or may not be where it's happening. They'll do what's possible, and so that's the case. I mean, that's a whole separate issue, though. The bottom line is regulations will happen, taxes will happen, it's all going to occur. How is it going to occur? I couldn't tell you. I mean, it's going to happen how it happens. I don't know what it's going to be. But the concept of will it happen? Absolutely it will. In the other countries, it started out overtaxed, overregulated, incredibly expensive, and it's only going to get better. Here, it started out the frontier. We're now to where there's some city settlements and some places where there's some sharecroppers moving in. And it's getting settled enough that the real frontiersmen are starting to feel cramped. And the city people are starting to think it's still too out of control to be near. And it'll move its way on until it gets thoroughly brought into... I mean, that's inevitable. That's how it's going to go.
It's only going to happen unless people let it happen.
It's going to happen. It's like the frontier. The frontier could not remain open. How long it stayed open could be changed. How it closed could be changed. Whether it closed could not be. The terms under which it closed can definitely be affected. And that's where the focus should be.
Bob Metcalf, totally out in left field, saying that the internet's going to collapse or the domain name system.
Man, calling Bob Metcalf out in left field, something I don't really want to be on record doing. It's a guy probably knows more in his worst day than I'll know in my whole life. But I think so, because I have great faith that technology outruns the problems when it's basically as primitive as it is today. We are in such primitive part of the internet technology right now as to roughly equate to radio when we were using spark gap transmitters and coherers. Perhaps we're up to a carbon microphone here and there. And so the technology's just got all this distance to travel. And when it's got that much distance to travel, I just can't believe we're anywhere near a limit yet. And the economics behind making it travel that distance are so much in its favor that I just think it's got to happen. But who knows? You know, sometimes the sky does fall.
The domain name system in jeopardy at this point?
The domain name system as currently structured is in jeopardy. But the internet as currently structured is in jeopardy. But it's already, you have to understand, in the last 3 years, the internet has been torn down and completely rebuilt, every wire and every router, 5 times. Everything you see in the internet wasn't here 3 years ago, and everything you saw 3 years ago is gone. So 3 years ago, I could tell you the internet was going to die. And today I can tell you it did. But you didn't notice, because it got replaced right about the time it died.
The IP addressing scheme.
IP addressing scheme can be managed a lot of ways. There is the new TCP/IP addressing scheme that's backward compatible dictated. Whenever it's in trouble, that can be rolled out pretty quickly. But the fact that there's not much attention being paid to it tells you that the problem is not very real. There are enough TCP/IP addresses for every man, woman, and child on the earth to have one and have a billion left over. But as you will see when we get into routing and addressing, you'll see why there's a problem, and it has to do with how it's currently administered. And that administration could be changed under pressure, probably changed 2 or 3 times. So where the addressing space suddenly gets 8 times bigger than it is, and then 16 times bigger. But it's going to be unpleasant, because a lot of administrative structures are going to have to change, and it won't be easy for them to do. But if the pressure's high enough, they'll change them rather than die. Well, it's break time now, and we'll take off and be back here at 11, and we'll start into DNS.